This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Ben, hi.
Hello.
Ben is with me, and you are with us on the Gravity Commons podcast. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for welcoming me and us to the show.
Well, no, Christy. She's got summer, join with us. Summer duties. Yep.
Not today.
But we are here. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, Ben, if you have any recommendations for us.
Wow, recommendations.
Things you're reading or things you're watching or...
I just heard about a song that I was just about to check out. Kristen Dumais, from her Substack that she pointed out. It's a song called Jesus and John Wayne. And it's by Allison Ponthier, Googly Eyes, and Joy Aladokun, who actually, I've heard Joy Aladokun play. She played a concert here in Indianapolis one time. And my wife really likes that artist. Anyway, I was just about to listen to it. I've heard a little clip on Instagram, and it sounds pretty good. But listen to these lyrics. I liked the teachings of Jesus so much that I followed him right out the door. When steeples kept preaching with hate on their tongues and distaste for the meek, mild, and poor, and I found my heart, give it away. You can have them both, Jesus and John Wayne. It's got an F-bomb in it, which I'm not going to quote here, but that's the next line. What an effing shame. And I lay me down. The sacrifice had to be made. Anyway, isn't that interesting?
That is interesting, man.
Jesus and John Wayne. I don't know if they read the... I don't know who the other artists are, Googly Eyes. I know Joy Aladokun, though. So that's fascinating.
Okay.
I've never heard of... You can find it on Spotify. Anyway.
Interesting. All right.
Maybe I can play a little bit of it, I guess.
So you're recommending a song you've never heard before.
All right. We're all listening to it now together. Oh. I'm going to aim the mic at the speakers here.
Can we do this? Does this violate?
We could probably do a little clip of it, but other than that,
can I talk to you for a second? I think you were.
Hey, come over here. Here's the first one. Jesus so much that I followed him right out the door. All right. That's probably all we can do according to copyright.
You have no idea.
No clue. No clue. But it feels right that we could do a clip and hopefully the AI bots won't find it and cancel us.
I don't have a recommendation, but I'm looking for them. We could use a good copyright defense attorney. And if you know somebody.
Yeah. Anyway. Hopefully they'll only appreciate the fact that I played a little clip. I teased everybody. Now go and listen to it. You know?
Yeah.
Who could be mad about that? Nobody.
Who could?
Nobody could be mad. All right. Yeah. Do you have a recommendation?
I'm rewatching The Good Place.
Oh,
remember that TV show that came out 10 years ago?
That's a fun one.
I think it's a fun one. And if you watch it and you demand that it demonstrate and teach Christian theology, you will be frustrated and disappointed.
Sure. Yeah.
If you watch it for the jokes and for a humorous way to dramatize complex moral and ethical issues, then I think you'll like it.
Yeah.
So that's my rec.
I agree with that one. I've been thinking about shows to rewatch, and I've wondered if so far we just have too many new shows that we want to watch.
Right.
But if we ever get bored, I was thinking Parks and Rec. I would rewatch that series.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I thought about that too. I think you got to get through season one. Season one, it takes a while to warm up.
Yeah, they had to figure out what the show was about. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It wasn't about the main character.
It's kind of like The Simpsons.
Yeah.
It's like The Simpsons.
Yeah. They thought it was about one character, and it was actually an ensemble.
Yeah.
They had to figure that out.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, yeah. By way of segue, let's just do a hard pivot. Who are we talking to today, Matt?
Thanks for that hard pivot, yeah, Ben.
Sounds good.
We're talking to Andrew Root. He is the Kerry Olson Balson Professor to Youth and Family Ministry at Luther Seminary. He is the author of more than 20 books,
man,
and hosts the influential When Church Stops Working podcast. Today, we chat with him about his latest book, Evangelism in an Age of Despair, Hope Beyond the Failed Promise of Happiness. Let's get into it.
Here we go.
Andy, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, welcome back, I should say. We've had you on to talk before about your ministry in a secular age series, which is at like 5 books now. I wonder, did that series just happen to you? I mean, or did you set out to write a series of 5 books? How did that come to be, and is it finished?
Yeah, well, it is finished in the sense that I promised readers there would be no more, because it was stated as 3 volumes, and it did balloon to 6. And this one that we're going to talk about later here today could be 7, but I promised there would not be a 7. So I have circumvented the rules, you know, like with your children, where you're like, I didn't lie. I just, like didn't tell you everything you needed to know. That's basically what's happened with this evangelism book. So, it definitely could be 7, but it's not, because I said it wouldn't be. So
one of the hallmarks of that series, and I think of all the books that I've seen of yours, is that you tend to bring a really broad and deep perspective from history and anthropology and sociology and theology to bear on a current cultural question or moment, you know, something we need for right now. And I wonder, like, how did that come to be? Are you just reading? I mean, I see the books behind you. Are you reading the stuff like your French philosophy and Martin Luther, you know, as you, you know, do your morning devotions? Or is this something that you really have to work at, and it's a discipline for you?
Yeah, first of all, it's like completely self-indulgent. So I feel a little bit like embarrassed by it in some ways. I mean, I think, you know, like, not to get like too under the hood a bit, but writing any project, you're kind of on the precipice and, you know, out on the edge, and you're just like, do I have anything to say? And you're just looking for some dialogue partners to help you kind of to mix metaphors here, kind of mine out what you sense or what you feel. So that for me has often been a pretty broad template of different thinkers and things like that. And yeah, there is a discipline in the sense of just reading a lot. And, you know, I in another life, if I would have been born in the 13th century or something, I would have lived up on that hill in a monastery and spent all my day in the same exact pattern, doing the same exact things. I feel like that's my only superpower in life, is that I can sit in one spot for a long time and kind of concentrate on a book, or, you know, or stare down the existential abyss of a blinking cursor to try to write something, that, you know, get something out of my
skill.
Head. So
that's a rare skill these days.
It is.
Incredible.
And, it is painful. I mean, I think that's one of the things people are like, you know, oh, it must be so great to write. It's like, no, it is a painful, you know, curse words all filled with how much pain is involved. I mean, there's it's beautiful too, and it's, you know, like any discipline, there's rewards in it, but it also is, you know, can you put yourself in jail? And if you're going to put yourself in jail, you need someone to accompany you in that, I guess. And so yeah. I've just read kind of broadly to try to make these points. So
yeah.
There's no like systematic kind of thing like, oh, I want to dip into this discipline, I want to dip into that one. I am trying, I think, to tell a story in some ways, but also never, I mean, this is the problem with working with Charles Taylor, is you realize there's never an easy answer. And so there's always that cultures and societies are just incredibly multivalent, and histories could have gone this way or that way. And the reason people hold certain goods is because of all sorts of different reasons. And you got to try to articulate those things. So, you know, it's part of the problem of being inspired by someone who writes 700 page books is all of a sudden you feel like you start dipping into that area, which is a very dangerous thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I love the metaphor of conversation partners. I think that helps me name why I read. I mean, I'm in the middle of 15 books, and I feel like I need lots of disciplines and lots of voices to help clarify and think through what I think. It's actually really helpful. And so it's encouraging to hear you say that. This new book, Evangelism in the Age of Despair, it's right there in the title. You identify despair or sadness as the zeitgeist of our modern age. And I wonder if you could just pontificate a bit about why do you think we are so sad?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you somewhat agree with me, Matt, that we're sad. It seems like you were conceding the point there with with the way that trailed off in a very kind of sad kind of way. That
was very well performed.
Exactly. That was very well performed, I felt like. Well, I mean, the larger point I would make is that we're really so sad because we're just so hell-bent on being happy. And that happiness has become kind of our summa bonum, our highest good that we're after. It's almost in some ways like you listen to middle class parents talk and it becomes like the concession, like, you know, all we want for our daughter is to be happy. You know, like like that should be the base level of what we want. I mean, that both says like at the end of the day, that's what really matters. It doesn't matter if she's on, you know, varsity volleyball. We just want her to be happy. It doesn't matter if she gets a scholarship or straight A's. We just want her to be happy. I mean, that shows a kind of concession and it's the highest good, but it also seems like something that we really should strive for, that we really want our children to have. And I think one of the interesting realities of this is like no pre-modern person would have ever thought the point of life is to be happy. You know, like that just is not, and really even kind of early modern people wouldn't have assumed that. It's kind of late modern people after a consumer society has dawned and that we've started to think like this is what the point of life is. Now, I'm not against happiness. I'm not, you know, I don't want to rain on anyone's happiness parade. Like, I think happiness is like money. If it comes into your life, you should take it. You know, like it's a good thing. The question just is, again, like money, is that worth living for? Like, is, you know, should everything in your life be set on trying to be happy? And I think we found ourselves in a particular moment where people really want to be happy. And yet these first three decades of the 21st century have been really quite sad. Decades. I think that, you know, they've been filled with a lot of anxiety and a lot of depression and a lot of kind of sense of structures giving way and just people feeling like, well, I think just the kind of shape of our the public space we have, which has become a fully digital one, pushes people in significant ways into isolation and ultimately pushes people to have no one to really bear their grief with, for the most part. Like the very structures of our discourse. You know, social media can do a lot of things, but it tends not to be great at giving consolation and helping you through just these core human realities of having to say goodbye and having to suffer and having to grieve. And yet we also fear those very core human realities. We're like, we want to avoid them like they're the plague because we think that they corrupt our happiness. And so, you know, you get this kind of double bind of trying to race away from any bad experiences, any negative experiences. And then when you find yourself in them, feeling quite alone to have to bear them in many ways.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation. Let's get back to the show.
I wonder if we can talk about that word consolation a little bit. You frame evangelism in this book as the, how did you put it? The practice and theology of consolation. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about what you mean by consolation and how it's different from happiness.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the point from earlier about, you know, drawing from so many different thinkers and things like that. I mean, first of all, I think that the largest mission I'm after in all these projects and the seven books and the other projects that have gone before this one is that I'm really trying to think every kind of practice I can, every kind of practical practice that a pastor or a minister would do, I'm really trying to think it through Luther's theology of the cross. That's the kind of inherent mission, I think, that maybe hasn't been expressed as directly as it should, but that's really what I'm after. So this project is really, okay, if evangelism is a practice of ministry, I mean, it's been part of the way the church practically engages the world for, you know, from its beginning. What would it mean to think through Luther's theology of the cross? And my argument here is that there's something really essential about consolation throughout the Christian tradition, of what it means to console our neighbor for the sake of embracing their humanity, of participating with them in sorrow, and that really a theology of the cross, this articulation that God meets us in places of suffering and loss, as Luther articulates it in the Heidelberg Disputation, I want to argue has its source not in a kind of atonement theory, really. I mean, there's part of that, but it really has it in a kind of pastoral theology of what it means to walk with our fellow Christians, but even more so, what it means to walk with our neighbor who isn't necessarily part of the community, what it means to be the kind of people that walk into sorrow with people because we feel like people matter. Primarily, and we believe in this kind of mystery of faith that Jesus Christ is present as the man of sorrows who brings life out of death, and so there's a kind of sacramental sense of what it means to share people's sorrow.
Yeah, you talk about the sacramental ontology of evangelism, and I wonder that's big language. And Ben and I are both from a sacramental tradition. I know Luther is from a sacramental tradition. Can you talk about what that phrase means and why that's important for your project?
Yeah, and the way I'm using it is, you know, other thinkers have used it as well, is to think of the sacraments as kind of analogical of a bigger reality, of having a kind of purchase into the larger reality, which really for me is this ultimate question of how the infinite participates in the finite, you know, so how, you know, so we do say like the presence of Jesus Christ is there. In the infinite presence of Jesus Christ is there in the finite presence of bread and wine. Like there, the Jesus Christ is found, his real presence is found there. And so I'm trying to extrapolate that idea to think about our relationships and what it means to really, really care for one another. And Luther made this assertion that we become little Christs to each other. And he meant that in this kind of encounter with the real presence of Jesus Christ. And so consoling becomes that reality. And I think trying to embed evangelism in this kind of sacramental vision, I think, frees it from the way I always experienced it growing up, that it became really dangerously instrumental, that it became a kind of strategy that you would wield. You know, there were even products that you could use when you wanted to do evangelism, or when you told high school kids to evangelize their friends, bracelets and, you know, obviously tracks and things like that, which maybe have their place, though I think have run the danger of becoming really quite instrumental, quite strategic, and losing the kind of mystery of the sacramental, which is what I'm trying to get to here, is, you know, what it means to encounter one another in the mystery of faith. And is that there's something really deep that happens within that, in that encounter.
Yeah. And that connects to, like, when we talked about a little bit, like, how did we get to an age of despair? Like, what are the artifacts of that? Mm-hmm. You mentioned sort of the lack of presence in much of our relationships, and the isolation and loneliness we feel. And I'm just struck by how this is a different way of thinking about evangelism, as you referenced, than what I thought. I mean, a bracelet can communicate some things, but what it doesn't communicate is, I see you, I'm with you. And I'm co-suffering or compassionate with you. Can you talk through a bit, like, because I think about you, at the end of your book, you talk about how it's good news, this theology of the cross that Luther has, that there's a suffering Savior, and how that brings us consolation. Can you talk through why that's, you know, better news maybe than if you give your life to Christ, it's up and to the right, you know? Like, yeah. How is that good news for someone who's in despair?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first move is, you know, kind of back where we started, just basically saying, like, you know, we have constructed a cultural reality where when people are suffering, which is an inevitable reality. So, you know, the title despair here is kind of referring to just deep unhappiness. I mean, there's a bit of an echo to, like, Kierkegaard or something, where, you know, there's more of an existential kind of sense of this, like what it means to be human is to have to deal with limit and finitude and things like that. And so therefore, you know, you despair because you live, you know, just because you are a creature who can't fulfill yourself or something. And I do mean it that way, but I you know, the title here, which was more the publisher's title than mine, is this sense of, you know, just a really unhappy time that we're in. And, you know, I use a kind of through line of a fictional story that I've written here, which is, you know, like, back to your point, Matt, about how weird these books are, because a lot of them, you know, there's these major historical conversations. I call this my French book because it's all these French thinkers, because I think they're the inventors of happiness as the prime aim of our life. But then there's also these kind of fictional stories because, you know, like I said, I'm trying to be a practical theologian. And to me, that means not necessarily giving you surveys and sociological graphs, but it means that I have to stay concrete and I have to talk about practice in some way. So I've used fictional narrative to do this. And the real inspiration of this whole project was reading a book called The Gospel of Wellness, which was about this New York Times writer who had been writing about the wellness industry for decades, or for at least a decade. And she said, you know, that she was a full believer in kind of wellness and, you know, diets and sleeping on a cold pillow or whatever other new, you know, thing there was, an asparagus diet or something, and said that, you know, then her father died and no yoga instructor came and sat with her. And she was someone who was, like, very post any religious community. And yet what she longed for most was for someone to come and just be with her. And of course she would write on, you know, Facebook or, you know, whatever, social media, Instagram or whatever, and be like, you know, so sad my father died, and get all these emojis of sad faces. But there was no one who came and stood in the breach with her. Mm-hmm. No one who gave her a larger story that gave some coherence to what it meant to bear this incredible loss. And so it is really kind of thinking of that and what it means to be a human being is to be on a pilgrimage, in a pilgrimage where you have to say goodbye, you know, and yet we formulated a culture where we have no spaces for that, that we used to have within families and within other communities and with civic organizations and things like that. We don't have any of that. And then we do have a kind of implicit theology that tells us we should be afraid of that. Because if you're close to too many people who are suffering, then it corrupts your ability to be happy. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, hey, I see you. That's great. But don't get too close to me.
It's like a contagious disease or something. It's an airborne pathogen.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It becomes that. And yet, you know, within the Christian tradition, it's very different what we think. It's like shared suffering becomes a place where death is overcome in many ways, where something bigger is witnessed to. Like, there's this is the kind of sacramental reality of like these opposite things, like sharing in, walking towards sorrow and suffering should be something quite, it should be an articulation of where God can't be. And yet this is the theology of the cross. Is it makes this articulation where God shouldn't be found is where God is found. And so I think what evangelism ultimately becomes is asking people in companionship with the community to lean into their suffering, not in a kind of masochistic death metal Norwegian, you know, thrash metal kind of way, but in a way that says, we believe you'll find something there. Like, we believe there's a great presence that meets you in there. And so instead of using religion to kind of numb you from that, or instead of using whatever kind of consumerism or whatever other kind of cultural trope to avoid that, what if you fell into that? What would you discover there? And it is the confession. I mean, this is the proclamation or the kerygma of the gospels, that this community has found that Jesus Christ is there, that this is the God who takes what is dead and brings life out of it. And so, yeah, Luther really wants to articulate that those experiences of loss, I mean, Moltmann is the most, recent person who's wielded this so beautifully, is that, you know, that God knows these experiences within the Trinitarian reality itself. So the very, if you will, the ticket into that, which too often in evangelism, you're like, evangelism is the ticket to heaven or something. But the entryway into this participation in God's being isn't in what you do or what you resist or what you deny, but in these experiences of loss and death, that puts you in communion with God, because God knows those experiences within the life of the Trinity.
Yeah, you know, I'm struck again as I listen by how one of the biggest paradigm shifts for me was that discipleship and evangelism are really the same thing. Mm. That what we're calling, you know, what we're calling others into in evangelism is the same thing that we are continually being called into, mm-hmm. As followers of Christ and as people who are learning to walk the way of the cross with Christ. And I wonder, you know, what, so oftentimes we think of evangelism as speech,
yeah,
as some sort of like sales pitch, or, you know, it's words that are meant to convince someone to do something. And I wonder if you can comment briefly on just the importance of embodiment. I mean, you talked a little bit about this, like from a sacramental point of view earlier, but what's the importance of the community of faith embodying the thing that they're inviting people to join them in?
Yeah.
I don't know if you can comment on that briefly.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to me, I was trying with this thought experiment of this story to play that out. What would that look like? Mm-hmm. What would it look like for a community that doesn't do evangelism, but is essentially just evangelistic in their life? You know, like it's not a strategy, it's not a program, it's just who they are, because they are seeking for who Jesus Christ is, and they're trying to embrace the world and love the world, and this just essentially sends them out, because they're disciples of Jesus Christ. It sends them out into the world to follow Jesus Christ, where Jesus Christ can be found at the cross. So, you know, and the person who's running HR for a trucking company and then for an apparel company just all of a sudden is confronted by this person who's suffering and has to respond. And so there is, you know, for me, there's always Bonhoeffer in the back of my mind. And so, you know, Bonhoeffer really defines discipleship is following Jesus Christ. You know, that's Nachfolge. It's mm-hmm. to follow. But really, you know, and Bonhoeffer is really playing this out within the Lutheran tradition, particularly, to follow Jesus Christ is to follow Jesus Christ to your neighbor. And your neighbor is a human being, who is filled with incredible beauty, but that beauty is, often seen in longing and in brokenness and in the call to receive and to give ministry, really. You know, I'm thinking of ministry in a very broad kind of way. And so all evangelism really is ministering to our neighbor. And so it's done without words in the sense of what it means to really embrace you, what it really means to journey with you, to join you on this journey. Like, you know, you are on a pilgrimage when you go to the doctor and you get diagnosed that you have cancer. Like, you are now on a different path in life. And I think so often those paths, either like thinking of just the cancer path, like it becomes very triumphalistic in some ways. Like, we're going to fight this thing. You're going to beat this thing. And, you know, no one has time to hear about how this like just throws your life up in the air. Or you are on the path. I mean, we hate to say this, but we all are on the path to dying. You know, there's no way around that. It's what it means to be a human being. And of course, utterly all out happiness seekers, we would hate to be reminded that we're going to die, as most middle-class Americans are very much hate being reminded they're going to die. But it also means that we're the kind of people who don't believe, unlike our Christian ancestors, that we're on a pilgrimage. And what a pilgrimage is walking towards Jesus. You know, it's walking towards the sacred. And I think that walk, maybe a critique of the medieval system, is that walk too often was a bit individualistic. And I think what we want to do now is walk as a community, as people are on this journey. And it really doesn't matter if they're a confessional Christian or they're part of our community. What it means to be the salt and light of the world, what it means to bring the good news, is to journey with people in these pilgrimages. And it is to give words. I mean, so that's without words, but it is to give words, which is, we believe there's a presence here. We believe that the resurrected Jesus Christ finds us. And it seems incredibly odd. And it seems to the Greeks quite foolish. You know, it seems like a foolish thing that we would do. And there is a foolishness in it, because it doesn't promise any happiness. You know, you can't say to your community, like, if you walk with people in suffering, you're going to be so happy. No, it doesn't promise any happiness, but it does, I think, promise, in communion with the Spirit, a sense of joy, a sense of what it means to participate in kind of brokenness and to witness towards wholeness. So it does take words of saying we're here because we follow this Jesus Christ. And, you know, we follow this word that, you know, because we follow Jesus Christ, we follow him into sorrow. And it's a wager, it's a bet, you know, but, it's a kind of bet, I think, that can renew the church itself, but also can be, allow the church to be a blessing to the world.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
We've already referenced how you bring lots of voices into conversation. I mean, Charles Taylor is the gift that keeps on giving for much of your work. But yeah. I was delighted to see in your chapter entitled Sisters as Pastors that you put us in conversation with Macrina. And I wonder if you could just give us, maybe by way of a flavor of how you do this, like, give us an intro to who she is and how she contributes to your project.
Yeah, well, I mean, she is, if you, you know, for my money, she's the greatest Christian teacher we've ever had. You know, like, she's the sister of two of the Cappadocian fathers. So she is the sister of Basil the Great, or Basil of Caesarea, and then of Gregory of Nyssa, who ends up writing these reflections on her and telling her story. And that's where we find out all about her, because she's, for Gregory particularly, I mean, Basil's a little bit of like the oldest brother. You know, he's the oldest male in the family and was a little conceited, and you even kind of get that sense from Gregory. Gregory was a younger brother. And I think that even Basil would have conceded that Macrina was his teacher, but for Gregory, she absolutely is. You know, this incredible mind of the early church, that she is the great teacher. And what's happened in this, he's telling a story as he's on pilgrimage, ironically or not. I mean, I think this, you know, these reflections come out when you're on pilgrimage. So he's walking to the Holy Land, and he meets a fellow monk, and he wants to tell him the story of his great teacher, of his sister. And it's really a big question of, you know, for the early church, what do you do if you believe in resurrection? Do you grieve? Is it appropriate to grieve? Is it appropriate to be sad in the midst of this? I mean, this is a big kind of issue. And for both Basil and the two Gregories, like, there's a lot of letters of consolation that they write to folks. Like, you know, you're a Christian, but, you know, your 12-year-old just falls off a wall and dies. Like, are you supposed to grieve or are you not? You believe in the resurrection. And they always tell their people to grieve, like to absolutely grieve, and that God meets us in that grief. But yeah, in this story Gregory tells, Macrina has died. But he tells us about the ways that she has taught him. And then we're told that he absolutely just grieves over her loss, and kind of, you know, throws himself down and just is so deeply sorrowful, but really believes that in these experiences of sorrow that God moves and that God consoles. And so it becomes a kind of another example, becomes one of our earliest examples of a consolation theology of what it means to actually be consoled. And I think really probably more fairly, it becomes a consolation philosophy. Like, what does it mean to really grieve? What does that look like? And then a few centuries later, there's a very famous book called Consolation Theology that all the medieval folks read. That was like a prime on your syllabus. And then we get, and this is the kind of link back to Luther, a French Parisian who writes the Consolation of Theology. So he shifts it from, Gersau is his name, and he shifts it from a consolation philosophy to a consolation theology. And this is a big move, because he's writing this in kind of in a scholastic world of big ideas and theorems and things. And he actually says, you know, what we really need is a kind of theology that helps us live, that helps us grieve. And theology becomes a way of recognizing the presence of God in our deepest human experiences. And the irony or not is that a great fan of Jean Gersau was Johann Stupitz, who was Luther's confessor. And taught Luther to put his eyes on Jesus Christ. And Luther gives all the credit for his own theological breakthroughs to the ministry of Stupitz, who in Luther's great anxiety and temptation, Stupitz would sit with him and bear his burdens. And when he would be worried about predestination and God damning him, Stupitz would tell him to look at the gentle face of Jesus, and to never take his eyes off Jesus. So that's kind of my DNA test, that yeah. the theology of the cross is really built in a theology of consolation. So Luther wants us to think of even theology as something pastoral that helps us live, that helps us care for our neighbor, not just a way of proving something, you know, about God or about the church or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, in a world increasingly where we're told to, you know, doubt what our eyes tell us, or we're gaslit, or this reality distortion field's happening, where even AI makes it more impossible to know what's real or not. Mm-hmm. And where our entire political economy runs on the scarcity of happiness, and the promise or the threat of it. I think, your book functions as permission and freedom and faithfulness to tell the truth about suffering by expressing it through despair and sadness. And so it's a great gift, Andy. I'm so grateful for it. The title again is Evangelism in an Age of Despair, Hope Beyond the Failed Promise of Happiness. Thanks for being our guest today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, we talk about sadness a lot on this podcast, and the goodness and even necessity of telling the truth about bad things by feeling sad. Mm-hmm. And I'm in relationship with a number of people who their problem isn't that they can't be sad or don't want to be sad. Their problem is they can't stop being sad.
Mm-hmm.
They feel trapped or locked in grief or sometimes clinical depression. And I wanted to ask Andy about that. I didn't know if it would be fair, though. But yeah, I just kept thinking about people I love who, for whom sadness doesn't feel like a gift, and maybe haven't experienced Christ's suffering as consoling enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that you know, his book isn't exactly about that. So I think that's right to maybe just canoodle on that thought here in this space. Because the other thing that I thought of, Matt, is just throughout the interview, we, what's the word? We used despair and sadness interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what I wonder, you know, obviously there's a point at which this becomes about semantics, but I do sometimes wonder if there's a difference between sadness and despair.
Yeah, say more.
I don't even know if I know enough to say any more about it, but I just wonder if there's a difference. I wonder if sadness is, I don't know, if I were to guess at like perhaps at least an initial attempt at distinguishing them. Sadness perhaps is the raw emotion that we feel in response to loss, mm-hmm. things that are sad. And we feel sadness.
But despair is more like a locked in sadness, like a...
It's almost like there's a story attached to the sadness that sends it into despair. Like a story, mm-hmm. like this is never ending, or this will never get any better, or like, you know, a subtle story that, you know, the kind that lives in our bones that doesn't, we're not conscious of it. We don't understand that we're doing that, but it's like the meaning we make of our sadness perhaps tips us into despair.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder that too. I also wonder, like, you know, I think about our interview with Eric Minton, It's Not You, It's Everything. I think about that a lot.
Years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. I think about the book a lot. And the point of his book is basically like a lot of the social antipathies we experience, including depression, mm-hmm. are products of our political economy. And, you know, Andy referenced that a little bit.
Right.
But I do think that mental health, the mental health crisis that is often referenced or we are experiencing in our own bodies or in our loved ones,
mm-hmm.
the temptation is to think, what's wrong with me?
Yeah. I'm not responding correctly to life.
And I wonder, like, maybe the people who are depressed, maybe there's the most things right with them.
Yeah. Like a canary in the coal mine.
Yeah. Yeah. They're the canary in the coal mine. Like they are most in tune and plugged into a dehumanizing system.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the rest of us are either too numb or too busy or too disassociated, you know, maybe where we don't have the capacity or the awareness of how bad things are. And so, you know, some of us carry despair, like, you know, the liver and the human body, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's something to that for sure. That there is a, you know, maybe there's some truth to that. Like, it feels like I can't stop being sad. Because, you know, he did say we live in an age of despair, but I think it's different. And I didn't hear him saying this necessarily, but like, it's a different thing to say we live in an age of despair. And that's because all of us have individually chosen to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we live in an age of despair because of the machinations of our political economy, have created conditions where we have to dehumanize ourselves to survive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what other condition would be, you know, would be appropriate in that kind of environment? You know, the other thing I think about is, you know, he mentions the last three decades and he talks about culture sort of like globally or overall. But I think there's probably a lot to learn from populations and peoples who have existed in very despair-inducing conditions in other times and places. You know, I think of the Black community and how they survived slavery.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If that's not a despair-inducing condition that somehow some sort of resilience and hope emerged out of, you know, I don't know what is.
Yeah, collectively, right?
Right, yeah.
But individuals within that, it broke them.
Yes, for sure.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
And so that tension of collective hope or collective resilience or collective, like he talked about, sacramental presence mm-hmm. or communicating the incarnation and the crucifixion in our co-suffering love is a part of how we repair and heal
yeah.
what the world is breaking.
Yeah.
You know, all this conversation reminds me of a question I've been wanting to ask you.
Yeah.
Do you know what the difference is between a cardinal attempting to rig the election for the new pope and a 1940s gangster attempting to purchase a newspaper is?
No.
I'm surprised you don't know.
Yeah. I never studied this.
Well, one is trying to buy the papacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is trying to buy a papacy.
See? The papacy. I was trying to come up with something about how they're like all Italians, but I guess you had talked about the difference. But anyway, I don't know.
Oh, you went to similarities.
Yeah, I did. I was thinking like gangsters, you know what I mean? That's like a trope.
That would be a new bit. If you were telling me jokes and the jokes mm-hmm. were questions, I would just talk for about 3 minutes straight on the answer to the question. I'd just make things up.
Yeah.
And I would just do like...
Just talk about what occurs to you.
Just do joke sabotage all mm-hmm. the time.
Yes.
This is one more area in your life, Ben, where you outdo me in showing honor.
Oh, yeah. You're going to say I'm blessed.
I'm happy to be...
Happy, you might say.
I'm happy to be last.
Yeah.
In showing honor.
Okay. Well, that's great. I feel like you'll be blessed. You'll be blessed because of it. Great is your reward in heaven, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, y'all. Good enough? Good enough for now?
Yes. Be blessed.
Be blessed, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the start recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.